Good afternoon, everyone, and I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Welcome to everyone, and welcome especially to the House members and the Subcommittee on Higher Education. Representatives and Chair Denbrough, would you like to gavel in, or do you need to do that?
I don't know if I need to, but I will. I'll call this informational meeting of the House Education Subcommittee on Higher Education to order.
Okay, and I would like to open a simultaneous public hearing on our three bills, Senate Bill 242, 253, and 254, for the purposes of a testament and all of those, because the speakers and people testifying will have a little bit of overlap as they come forward. What I would like to do by way of orienting the senators and reps up here is to very briefly spend a moment on how the task force came to these three bills. We've got some slides here, and I'd like to welcome the co-chair of that task force, Representative Tobias Reed, along with our Uber administrator, Dana Richardson, who helped us get where we are. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And we will get started. We'll dim the house lights. I did want to make one point here before we get into these bills, that anyone who doesn't think this is about the economy in Oregon or providing jobs, I want to cite a statistic that was first reported by Time last month that looked at the December unemployment rate in this country at 9.8%, but you can see it's less than half of that with those with college degrees, and surprisingly only 2% of women who have college degrees. You want to take it from here, Rep. Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Co-Chairs. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I had the honor of serving as co-chair of a work group during the interim. Some of you were on that work group, and I'm only disappointed to be here on this side of the dais because I think you all have the opportunity to do some very important things in a an environment where there are going to be no shortage of challenges. I think the package of legislation that the work group is introducing to you is one of those rare opportunities that you'll be able to talk to and point to in your home and your districts as a really, really positive step forward for the state, perhaps one of the most important things we can do. And the goals are very simple, to allow more flexibility, autonomy, and affordability to the system of education, and to think about it as a system of post-secondary education rather than individual institutions or a distinction that some of the experts who will come after us have pointed to between DOUS institutions and community colleges. We think it's absolutely essential to the future of the state.
Thank you. And as we move forward here, the task force members, Senator Morris, Senator Representative Springer, and Denbrough, feel free to chime in as we go through this.
So we have three proposals that the good chair referenced already in the three bills that are now open in public hearing. 40-40-20, the idea of expanding the availability and use of a dual credit system where students in high school can be earning college credits at the same time as they're progressing toward high school graduation. And a much larger bill that has to do with the governance and restructuring of the system of higher education. So 40-40-20, I expect you probably have all had some exposure to it, but it's very simply what's on the screen, the idea that we're going to set some goals for the educational attainment of Oregonians. And at the bottom is our current level. Why do we want to put this in statute? These are kindergartners who will be graduating from high school in some years, and we want to use this as a guide for ourselves as policies and proposals come before the legislature. We think it's useful to have this in statute as a compass, a method of evaluating proposals. Is this proposal driving us toward the 40-40-20 goal? Then we should pursue it. If it's not, maybe not. So we've talked already about the individual ones. This is just a picture of Senate Bill 253 and the specific language that talks about those goals. Dual credits, just very briefly, the idea that a student who is progressing in high school can earn credits toward college while they're in high school. I think it has at least two very significant advantages that allows a jump start. A student who might not otherwise think about post-secondary education as a viable option is more likely to if they have a number of credits at the time they graduate from high school. Perhaps more likely to think, well, maybe I should go on and seek an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And also is a significant cost savings. If you can earn some of those credits while you're in high school and avoid the associated cost of room and board, that's another big advantage. So that bill seeks to make it easier for students around the state to take advantage of dual credits. And our last one, I suspect, will occupy a good bit of the conversation today and in future hearings, seeks to change the status of the university system from a state agency to a public university. There are a lot of reasons that that's important, but essentially it's about granting flexibility and autonomy and letting universities be universities.
I should mention that there are about a dozen or 15 places here where the rubber hits the road. One of the examples that we use a lot is if Portland State University needs an attorney to work on a downtown Portland variance for one of its buildings, it has to go through the State Justice Department, which is timely and very expensive to the university, and this would change that. If a university wants to put a roof on a dorm, it has to go through the Department of Administrative Services. If it wants to build that dorm, it has to go through the legislature. It's very expensive. It takes a year to lose a construction season. And like I said, there are about 12 or 15 places like that that I think our task force, Sarah Morris, kind of went down through that list and said, well, this makes sense, this makes sense, this makes sense.
This is the bill I assume you've all read and have memorized by now. So we'll be, I think Senator Hass has a quiz prepared for a little bit later.
176 pages.
Okay.
The quiz.
And there's been a lot of conversation and even a little bit of coverage about this proposal, and some have seemed to describe the OUS plan and task force plan as separate. This is just meant to illustrate that they are very much the same. They are, for the most part, doing the same things. Our task force took on a little bit more than OUS did by including and considering the community college system, but by and large, we're headed in the same direction and very much consistent. The one place that I mentioned about community college where we differ a little bit, and this is also a good opportunity for me to congratulate and thank and acknowledge in public the tremendous assistance we received from the national experts you'll hear from this afternoon. Ames McGinnis, Dave Longenecker, and Dan Jones came from the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education and the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems. I'm envious. They got to come in with a wealth of knowledge and exposure and free from any particular allegiance in Oregon, able to say, this thing you do is great, this thing you do is crazy, and it was enormously valuable for us. Based a lot of what we did is based on their guidance and advice. One example of that is the idea of a coordinating commission that will help connect the different sectors of our post-secondary system, from the OUS system, the community colleges. OHSU is a dotted line on this diagram because they are a separate structure, and we want to acknowledge that, but we do want to make sure that we're coordinating the information and the kinds of inputs that they can provide into a broader consideration. It's worth mentioning and stressing that this commission is envisioned as encompassing what the Student Assistance Commission does now. So it is not creating a new commission. It will do those jobs and advise the governor and the legislature on the sorts of policies that we ought to be adopting in order to drive ourselves towards the 40-40-20 goal.
And I would just point out that this coordinating commission will have community colleges and universities sitting at the same table for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that's really increasingly important in this state as more and more universities are enrolling students who come with some community colleges credits on their transcript.
So those are our three concepts. I think it would be an understatement to say that they are complicated, at least Senate Bill 242 particularly. But again, I think they are among the very most important things that this legislature could do, and I'm eager to assist you in your consideration of them.
Thank you, Rep. Reed. Senators, you'll notice that we do have an amendment that is fairly technical, but very important to OHSU. Essentially, saying that this bill will have limited effect on OHSU. Dana Richardson is here. If you can summarize that amendment, and I hope that we can adopt that later this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and co-chairs. For the record, Dana Richardson, Legislative Director for Senate President Pierre Courtney and staff to the Higher Education Work Group. And the Dash Plan amendments clarify that while OHSU would feed information into the Coordinating Commission, that they are not related in the same way that OUS institutions and community colleges are to the Coordinating Commission. I hope that's good enough.
Succinct. So, with a lot of ways to go here today, let me see if there are any questions of you two. Okay.
I do have a question, Senator, and maybe this is to you, Dana. In the slide where we saw the sort of org chart for the Coordinating Commission, there was a reporting line from the Commissioner of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to the Commission, and that was sort of in the middle place between the colleges and the Commission. Under 242, what is the what's the role of the State Board of Education, which currently has governance authority over the community colleges?
Representative Dembro and co-chairs, it's a great question. It's one that Rep. Reed or Senator Haas could speak to as well. I think one of the challenges in representing the structure visually is that it can you can't tell looking at it whether it's a governance board or a coordinating board. So it's a key question, and the intent, I believe, is to have it be a coordinating commission, not a governance commission. That being said, the community college structure and relationship with the State Board of Education would remain as it is today.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Mr. Co-Chairs, I might just echo that. I think that's exactly right. The intent is to have the commission help the legislature and the governor make the policy choices that lead us towards 40-40-20. It is not to be governing individual institutions.
And again, to reemphasize, this coordinated commission, lest anyone think we're adding a new layer or a new board, this is to replace the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, which will be dismantled. But the functions will be carried out by this commission. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I really wish that our task force could take credit for all this brilliance. Fortunately, we were guided by three experts who helped us last year, and they are here with us now. Dennis Jones, David Longnecker, and Ames McGinnis, if you are all here.
Okay. Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the committees, I am, for the record, Dennis Jones. I'm president of the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems. I'll let the other two individuals identify themselves.
I am David Longenecker, the president of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, WICHE.
Ames McGinnis at NCHS.
We're going to divide this up and leave time for a conversation. So we're going to hit some high points and then presume that you're going to have some questions. So just very quickly, a couple of points that drove all of this was an initial set of principles that said that it's really important to start with defining goals, and 40-40-20 represents such a goal, and then to determine the gaps between where you are and where you want to be, and then be very purposeful about what you do to close those gaps. And the things that legislatures can particularly do is allocate funds in a particular way that drive accomplishment, and to ask the question, are we making progress? What's the accountability mechanism associated with this? So that's where we started. We took the goals thing a little more broadly. It's 40-40-20, but it's also, you know, not just, particularly in the middle 40, it's not just any 40, but it's the question of how do you align education programs with workforce needs in the state. This can't be just unabashedly about more degrees, but it's more of the right kind of degrees. It's also recognizing the role of the research universities and saying that there is economic diversification and expansion required in all of this. And finally, that they have to pay attention to reduction of regional differences and differences among subpopulations. So at the end of the day, if you have 40-40-20, but huge gaps, particularly between whites and minorities, you haven't succeeded yet. So, and this is, you know, I've got just...
Dennis, hang on for a second here. Yeah. You're not showing up here. Your slides. You got all these pretty graphics. I wonder if F8 will get you there.
I wasn't even looking over there. I was looking at this.
They were looking at you, too.
There we go. Now this I think is the picture that says a lot, and why 40-40-20 is important and why your attention to these issues is important. First of all, note that at least among young adults, the U.S. is 10th in the world as far as the proportion of young adults that has a college degree. Oregon is well below the U.S. average in this group, and more importantly, the direction is all wrong. 25 to 34-year-olds are less well-educated than any of their older, their parents' generation, the generation between them. So one of the problems that Oregon has is that whatever it's been doing, it's been falling behind rather than catching up, not just to the nation, but to the competition in the rest of the world. If you take a look at 25 to 64-year-olds, Oregon doesn't look all that bad. It's a little better than the national average, but if I back up just one, that's because us old folks got educated when the young ones didn't. And the real important point here is when the baby boomers walk off the stage, they have a huge gap, a replacement issue to be filled. And if you take a look at the countries that are way ahead of us, that is not true. When Korea or Japan have their retirees leave their workforce, they don't take nearly as much talent with them as is the case in the United States. If you compare it to 40-40-20, these are the gaps between where you are. And if you say 2025 is the place you want to close to, you have 11% that has less than a high school education. You have a lot more with high school. 15% that started college and didn't finish. And then very large discrepancies between certificates. That is less than associate degree, but vocational training programs typically. Associate degrees and baccalaureate. And if you take a look at the size of the gaps, the big gaps are at the community college level, particularly certificates. At the baccalaureate level, the gap is not that large, except there are, this is a presumption, that Oregon will continue to import a lot of baccalaureate degree attaining talent. And so if all of those folks that used to come here from Montana or wherever decide to stay home, that number could quadruple as far as the size of the gap. And just to put this in perspective, why it's important, the reality is that there's a almost direct linear relationship between education attainment of a population and the income of that population. That the states that are at the very high end of the economic ladder are also very well-educated populations. And also, Oregon is one of the few states that has a high ranking in technology as far as the economy and doesn't make it to the right-hand side of this chart. I mean, Oregon, Utah, Delaware kind of fall into those categories of having technology-oriented economies, at least in some measure, without having the commensurate education attainment levels and income levels that are associated with that. So,
as we worked with the work group this summer, based on those principles that we laid out at the beginning, those goals that were established, and essentially the conditions that Oregon faces, we sort of came up with a simple, straightforward assessment of what the state has an obligation to do. The first thing is to set those goals. You know, as the old saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, any path will get you there. Well, sort of the opposite of that one is you really have to have goals and well-established goals in order for your institutions to have a good idea of what you expect of them. And if you're going to have a strong accountability system associated with what you do in the state, you've clearly got to have goals to measure progress toward the accomplishment of those goals. And if you have, once you have that goals and that goal structure in place, then you've got to create a financing framework that will ensure adequate educational capacity to meet those goals as you move forward. And then third, you've got to have that accountability structure and measurement toward that accountability. So you're really talking about what you need to do as a legislature and as this state government is you've got to define what it is you want as a state, and you've got to come up with a way of measuring whether you're achieving that or not. What you need to do, we believe, and is a problem in your state, is that you've got to basically trust and leave it to the institutions to determine how best to do that. You hire, and in fact you have exceptional leadership in this state, in your higher education system. They know well how to do education, and you've got to leave that how up to them, essentially. So, whoa, I got myself something there I don't know how to get rid of. What do I do?
Hit the X.
Hit the X? Yeah,
that was not the whole answer.
What you do is just go right up here to skunk out
there. So, if one takes a look at that and you look at those principles that we established as the first principles, we're adding some additional ones. I think I actually missed maybe a... Yeah. The first of those critical principles that we came up with was to formulate the policy from the perspective of the state and its citizens, not from the perspective of the providers of the service. The institutions are critically important to you, but they are means to the end, not the end in itself. And to some extent, your policy in the past has focused more on institutional needs than on the state's needs and the needs of the citizens. And so we're suggesting that your responsibility is really to focus on the states and its citizens. And to do that, we're arguing that you need a system of higher education. You need to think of higher education as a system rather than as a series of individual institutions or as a group of universities and colleges. But rather than that, you need to think of it all as one system and to encompass all of those together. And we've suggested that that includes the Oregon University system, the community colleges, the voc ed centers, the post-secondary voc ed centers, your adult basic education activities, education, or ESL. And I would say one we left off of here, but there is a public purpose served by your independent sector, your private colleges in the state, and to the extent that you incorporate them into your public policy, you need a capacity to do that. Certainly you've done that in your financial aid policies, but they certainly serve a public good, and it's important to recognize that. Oops. I'm just doing a heck of that. There we go. And as you look at those, you need to make sure that the benefits of this accrue to all sectors of the state, geographically and in terms of racial and ethnic subpopulations. And essentially, there are gaps in both in regard with respect to both of those in the state. And your finance policies then should be structured to make sure that you're providing adequate resources to the institutions so they can do the job, but also to provide affordability. And when we talked about affordability, we meant affordability both to the citizens of the state and to the state itself. Sometimes we get carried away in our discussions of affordability and think it applies only to the students and their families, when in fact the state has limits on how much it can invest as well. And then we felt that this higher education enterprise has to be managed very efficiently. That's very clear in your state. Your state is one that we talked about as being what one might call frugal. Other people have different terms for that, but in fact, that's not going to change. Certainly isn't going to change overnight. And as a result, your system is probably going to have to be one of the most efficient systems in the country to provide high-quality post-secondary education with the resources that they come. And that's actually a reasonable expectation to expect of a system, that it will be as high a quality possible, consistent with the resources that it has. And that's true of both the system as a whole and each of the individual campuses. And then we also had discussions with the work group about what probably didn't make sense, where the value wasn't so high for change that was worth what we called the brain damage. One of those was to challenge the way in which you govern presently the community colleges through the State Board of Education. One is that we think that the Oregon University system with its 7 campuses is a good structure for your university level education. We weren't talking about institutional closures. That's not going to happen. It's not worth the brain damage of working on it. And we don't envision a substantial change in your tax or your revenue structure such that it would generate a substantially different amount of revenues for the state than you have at the present time. And we didn't see any changes that were necessary in the Oregon Health Sciences University and the changes, the significant changes you made in the governance structure for that institution a few years ago. Now, where we believe that change is extremely important, imperative, we've said, and worth the struggle, is that the relationship between the state and its public institutions really needs to change, and that change needs to be reflected both in your governance structures and in your finance structure. And that you really need to create a true higher education system, not an accumulation of those disparate interest. And, you know, we looked at what the Oregon University system has proposed, and I think it's really, from their perspective, a very good plan. They should be applauded for what they presented to you. But their responsibility was to look at the interest of the 7 institutions in the Oregon University system. Your responsibility is to look at the higher education system overall and the relationship between the universities, the community colleges, and all of those others, and to reflect those in terms of the state's
interest and the citizens' interest rather than the institutions. The Oregon University system did what it should have done. Now you need to do what you need to do. And we think there are distinct delineation of responsibilities between the legislature, the executive branch. We're proposing a new coordinating commission, the Oregon University system, the State Board of Education, and its responsibilities with the community colleges and then the local community college boards. And with that, we establish the Oregon University system as a government entity, but quite a bit different than the sort of state agency nature of it today in Oregon law. You would, if you made these changes, you would be moving more toward, we think, a modern management structure, one that a number of other states have been moving toward as well, where you create a much stronger accountability structure and consequences, both positive and negative, for achieving those the state goals, but where they remain public institutions, but they have much greater power to manage their operations, much as your community colleges today. And with that, Ames will describe precisely what we were suggesting, or semi-precisely, or something.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, because rather than duplicate a lot, I'm going to just summarize some points and then I think mostly answer questions from you. I've had the benefit of listening to how our original proposals were received through an interesting meeting I had with community college board members and presidents and with a variety of other groups, and I think that some of our initial language was not as clear as it could have been, and so I want to just touch on certain points which I think are really helpful, at least to me and to others, in understanding exactly what we intend. First of all, we have something which we call the Higher Education Policy Board. We would really urge that that not be called a board, and I think the current legislation has that in it, that in fact that it's called a coordinating commission. There's a very important reason for that. The board, the idea of board, implies that this entity would have a power is very similar to the governing board of an institution or a local community college board. So the language on this particular slide, we would really urge that it be called a coordinating commission rather than a board. Another point, people say, gee, you're just establishing another level of structure. What we had originally proposed in the current legislation does not do that. It really eliminates the separate entity for the student, for student assistance, and draws these together into one entity, which again plays a coordinating role. And again, what I'd like to underscore also, and it was brought up in the comments earlier, I have on this slide dotted lines, and that distinguishes between the function of coordination and governance. And I'd probably spend more of my time explaining this difference, so let me try one more time. It is very important for an institution, whether it be a community college or the university system, to have a board with responsibility for hiring and firing presidents, for establishing things like faculty personnel policies, for working on the operational activities, which several of you, I'm sure, have served on, whether it's local community college boards or school boards. That is what governance is all about. That's where essentially the decisions that are essentially managing institutions take place. A coordinating board plays an entirely different role. As David and Dennis pointed out, the focus of this entity is on Oregon and the future of the state and the way that the various entities that govern things in the state are really focused on the 40-40-20 goal. Our overwhelming experience, if a state does not have that kind of an entity, the sum of the interests of the various governing entities does not add up to progress of the state. Now, I'll be honest with you, I've had a lot of discussions with groups in Oregon, and what people realize, they do not focus on what Dennis explained, that while you think you've been making progress, the state actually has been going backwards, particularly with its younger population. You can focus on what the OUS is interested in and its priorities, and the community colleges and never understand and get a full picture of how it is important how those relate to each other and how both, in a coordinated way, are absolutely essential to move the state forward. So where our feeling is that kind of leadership entity, it does not run institutions, but it asks the questions, where is Oregon going, and what kind of alignment is there among the policies, particularly finance and getting you there, but it does not mess with and govern institutions. Now, the other issue relates to the community colleges, and I think a number of you may have had the experience of meeting with community college governing boards and presidents, and I wouldn't say I was roughed up, but they gave me some good perspectives about Oregon. So when we say it is not worth the brain damage, we definitely are not interested and suggesting in any way that their role be changed. Let me just give you a couple of points that are really important. It is very important that the local governing boards retain authority related to issues related to people, the personnel. There's a great deal of concern that if you suddenly get another entity, that those issues will move to a different level. This proposal does not do that. It retains the authority. Now, the authority of the local governing board. The other point relates to the State Board of Education. There could be a number of issues that Oregon is facing and will face that, in fact, a P20 kind of concern should be on the table. And the State Board of Education will be deeply involved in implementing the Common Core State Standards and other issues that relate to the community colleges. So in some respects, it makes sense to keep the State Board of Education involved in the picture, as this proposal does. So without going into the details of this, which are on subsequent slides, I just want to underscore coordination and policy leadership by the Coordinating Commission is absolutely essential for the future of the state to keep things focused. That's different than governance. We want to make sure that in our recommendation we're keeping the community college governance the way it is. And maybe just one final point about the OUS. This is absolutely a fundamental change in terms of changing the status of the OUS system. This is one of the few states that continues to essentially undermine the governing authority of that by intermingling it with the rest of state government. You simply cannot have a competitive university system if that happens. I'm working with countries around the world on exactly the same problem. In fact, you would be high up compared to other countries on the regulatory control that the state of Oregon still retains, as illustrated earlier. So that's a fundamental change. Now, the other point is what the role of a university system is. And this is a point a lot of people miss, and if you miss it, you wouldn't be surprised. It's very important for the university system across all the institutions, the smaller institutions and the other universities, have a coherent, integrated presentation to Oregon. That across rural areas, the different roles and missions. That system has to function as a coherent group. If you splinter off pieces of it, you lose that coherence, and a major benefit the state of Oregon has for that kind of university system. In fact, states that do not have that kind of coordination spend most of their time with essentially turf battles among the institutions within that kind of system. So deregulation and creating this new kind of entity essential, but maintaining the kind of coherence that presents across the diversity of missions, frankly, is something you really need to have, because you will waste your time on things you do not want to do if you really undermine that kind of coherence as a system. So anyway, in essence, that's what we are proposing, and again, we'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you all very much. Let's go to some questions. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The aspirational goals are important, but it seems to me that there's a linkage between the two measures that is lacking. You gave an excellent report on the gap. It was a gap report on where we are and where we wish to be. I don't see anywhere that links back in the measures in terms of by way of reporting or an analysis that is requiring some thoughtful consideration as to if we have this aspirational goal and we have the gaps, what will prompt us as policymakers to take this seriously if that isn't lifted up in some way that said, okay, we've got these goals, now what's our strategy to achieve them?
Well, I'll take the first shot at that. I think what we didn't want to presume what the role, what this coordinating body, this coordinating commission would come up with. That would be one of the major responsibilities of that coordinating commission, is to say, here's how we believe Oregon can and should move toward that 40-40-20 goal. And it's not just the aspirational goal. It's the continuous improvement toward those goals and the finding finance and accountability structures that would reward, that would send a very clear message to the institutions about the importance of making progress toward those goals. So envisioned in this is a strong role for the coordinating board in both the regulation and the finance structures that higher education would use to progress the state toward achievement of those goals. A very clear establishment of the metrics and progress toward those metrics, and not only the long-term sort of benchmark, but progress toward that and how you reward institutions for moving their metrics toward that, and putting the system together so that the sum of the parts equal the whole. Because right now that you don't have a structure in which that occurs. Is that responsive?
Yes, it is. I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, or House Chair, that in consideration of this, have we been clear enough in the measure to define what it is that we would like to have to develop that connectivity and then the response?
I just put this slide up because it makes very explicit development of state goals, accountability measures and metrics, and a plan for getting there. I mean, that is the charge of the coordinating commission, to come back to you with that set of recommendations. Don't make it your staff's work. Make it the coordinating commission's staff work.
Thank you.
Other questions on the House side? Thank you. I appreciated the earlier slides that talked about Oregon's relative status, I guess, on a national level in terms of higher education degrees and so forth, and really it's quite sobering information, and I appreciate that. One of my questions, though, is in regards to the 40-40-20 model or goal, what are other states doing? Do they have similar similar expectations, similar goals that have similar percentages, or is this just something that was a product of this work task force that came out of that?
I can tackle that one. This one is different than most other states because it makes explicit the 20.
Okay.
Because most of the goals that we are hearing are solely about post-secondary. Second of all, most states are framing their goals around the kind of 60% by 2025. So your 80% is higher. At the same time, yours explicitly recognizes certificates where the other ones do not. But yes, there are states, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, several others, West Virginia, several other states have got goals of this variety and generally in this ballpark.
I might just add something. Many of the other states are sort of driven by the president's goal, where he laid out that he wanted the United States by, I think it was 2020, actually, to lead the world again. And so they looked at what the best in the world was, and they sort of pegged to that. That, however, there's sort of a flaw in that logic. That presumes the rest of the world is now going to remain static and wait for us to catch up. And so I think in some respects, yours is, while it's clearly a stretch goal for your state, given you're sort of behind the ball already, and it's a stretch goal for the nation, it may be that we need stretch goals if we really want to gain preeminence in the education level of our adults in the future.
Thank you. You're here. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. one of you, thanks so much for all the information and for the context that you provided. One of you alluded to the role that might be played by some of our private institutions. We have some very fine ones here, one right across the street, several others around the state. Would you care to elaborate on the role that we might encourage them to play, or any other aspect of your thoughts in this area?
Well, it's actually, I think, one of the benefits of having a coordinating body is because then you can be more intentional about your policies. Then, I mean, you can't really expect the Oregon University system to make the case for Willamette, and you can't really expect the community colleges to make the case for George Fox or something like that. I mean, that's not the way life works when your primary responsibility is, in fact, your institution. When your primary responsibility is the state, you recognize the value of non-state actors in the presence of that. And in fact, in your financial aid program, which I tend to be fairly fond of, I think we all think it's a really strong program that designed for shared responsibility that you have, it does recognize the importance of the independent sector of higher education. Similarly, one of the roles for this coordinating body would be that it would have responsibility for the approval of those institutions, those that exist and those that come in, to make sure that they're serving the needs of the state, both the nonprofit independent students and the for-profit institutions that came in. So I think that it allows you to have a legitimate sort of I don't want to say unbiased, but it eliminates the conflict of interest in the development of public policy around the value of those institutions. Gosh, if you didn't have those institutions in the state, think about what the implications financially would be for your public system, which logically wouldn't have a lot more money than it has today, but would have somewhere between 15% and 20% more students.
Yeah. One of the things that I would just note, and I'm not going to, and by noting it, I'm not going to suggest you follow, okay? But if you take a look at the state of Indiana, that has goals and gaps and et cetera, coming out of their higher education public policy group, their coordinating commission, working with their governor, they have basically invited Western Governors University into the state. They now have Western Governors University, Indiana. And they've expanded the delivery capacity of higher education in the state by the action of making students in that institution eligible for student financial aid, and no other expenditures of state funds. That's just an example of taking a look at the problem, taking a look at public resources, and then saying, but we need some more help. How do we get that? And that is an example of that kind of policy.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in regards to the 40-40-20 plan, which I think is great, I don't know if there's anything magical about those numbers, but after we look at the graph there, we need some numbers to be striving towards. And I think it was you, Dennis, that brought up a great point, and I want to make sure maybe to draw some attention to that a little bit. I think that those numbers are very important. I think that that's a very important goal. And I realize that this is the subcommittee on higher ed, but I think an important element that I don't often hear in the conversation when we're talking 40-40-20, and you briefly mentioned it, is that we have a matching workforce and that we keep in mind policies in this state that allow these people, 40-40-20 folks, to have some opportunities out there at the end. So I realize, I don't know if it's the egg that comes first or the chicken that comes first. I don't think that's where we need to focus our attention, but I think we need to focus it on both places.
Yeah,
and I think you brought up a great point.
Yeah, and one of the things that's getting much more national attention is, you know, there's a lot of good work now coming out that says, you know, if you get a very vocationally job-oriented one-year certificate, you can make a fair amount of money, and you can make more money than many associate degrees that are less focused. You can make more money than many baccalaureate degrees that are less focused. And so attention to that part of the education and training capacity of the state and the connection to the workforce is really an important conversation. And it's one of those things that, you know, as I look around the country, it's not the kind of thing that happens without a state-level look. You know, that individual institutions left to their own devices probably won't go there. And you've seen it in your own state with the need to invest in nursing programs where the capacity wasn't there by institutional action and et cetera. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing that a coordinating board can look around and say, what do we really need to buy from these institutions that they, out of student choice alone, aren't getting us?
Representative.
Yes, thanks. So I'd like to take advantage of this huge amount of brain power that we have, you know, sitting at that table. to help us with a few of the sticky issues that are still out there, you know, kind of surrounding the Senate Bill 242. One of them has to do with the question of local boards. Right, whether or not, you know, under this, is this projected system that would include a coordinating commission, is there room to also have individual institutional boards for the universities, or is that something that there would not be room for? And I'd like to get your perspective from a national perspective, as it were, of, you know, where local boards seem to work well and where they don't. So that's one question. Another has to do with the notion of a higher ed board versus a P20 board. You know, as I think you know, our governor is interested in a board that would actually be more comprehensive than just a higher ed strategic board, but rather, you know, would include pre-K all the way through the university. And I wondered if you have examples around the country in which that model has worked or has not worked. This is, you know, another sort of sticky issue, is the question of authority for setting tuition, right? There is a lot of concern that, you know, if we move the OUS from being a state agency status, that the legislature loses some control and tuition may go out of line, you know, under that kind of scenario. So I wonder if you could help us with those three areas that I think are still out there.
Well, the first couple.
Yeah. Let me do a quick answer on the thing. First, on boards. I think I've gotten lots of questions about that because I develop an obsession with cataloging all the states. And this is the misperception. You've got to think of states that have something like an OUS, where all the public universities are under a statewide governing board. There are only two or three examples in the United States where those statewide boards also have institutional boards. And those have grown up over a particular circumstance. Then there are about half the states, and it's not exactly, that do not have an OUS. What they have is a policy board of some type, and then every institution in the state has a governing board. There are a few states like that, not very many. In fact, only three in the country that really stand out, and actually your neighbor in the state of Washington is that kind of operation. Now, so part of the question is, I've gotten the question, oh, gee, a lot of other states with major universities have local governing boards. Generally, no. If you look at the top-ranked AAU institutions, by and large, they are in with university systems like OUS, and they do not have governing boards. For example, you don't hear people talking in California about why Berkeley needs its own governing board. In fact, if you look at the history of the University of California, the people who created that system did so for a very deliberate reason. What was happening is that Berkeley was a strong institution, and then as the interests in Los Angeles wanted to have a university. They all of a sudden, the system was, the whole state was beginning to splinter apart by geographic competition. So they deliberately decided with Clark Kerr at the leadership that they needed a unified system that would not be constantly ripped apart by essentially the geographic divisions. So it's there are other reasons why you have boards within OUS, but to simply say, oh, well, other universities have local governing boards, yes, they do, but if they're outside a system, and not very major, very many major universities are outside a system. Okay. Now, so that's, we can answer more on that thing, but now there is a question of what the benefit is within a system of having local boards. I would say that, in fact, it is helpful for a major university to have a an advisory body, which is important for fundraising, and many universities have foundation boards. There are lots of ways to get alumni and other people involved as advocates of a university. What gets very confusing is when that board is called a board, thinks it's making governing decisions, and essentially moves ahead on its own agenda, which is inconsistent with the way the system works together. You've got trouble in that, and I've lived through it in my own life. I did. Basically because the advocates around that operation have no interest in the system. They have advocacy for one institution, then you're back in the same soup. Now, on the P20 thing, I just want to make a distinction, and my colleagues can do this. It is very difficult in this country to merge the operational features of higher education with the operational dimensions of K-12. Higher education strategy will be driven out in a flash in a minute, because the issues in K-12 are very different. The role of the state is very different. If you look at what's on the agenda, even the State Board of Education, there are a whole set of regulatory issues. Frank, there are a lot of issues that are federal that are essentially implementation issues. So you, any state, and you have a neighboring state that's thinking of mushing this all together, what I simply say is that will not lead to statewide strategy. It will lead to essentially dominance of essentially administrative issues and wiping out any attention to strategy. Now, it makes a great deal of sense for a state to think of a goal like 40-40-20, which cuts across all those areas. And I think we have suggested in the wording of this that as they develop, as this new policy, this coordinating commission in Oregon develops that overall strategy, it ought to work with the State Board of Education so that those goals do reflect the whole system. You don't need a whole new structure about that, but by definition, the kind of structure we're talking about, Representative Dumbro, would have a P20 thing, but I wouldn't merge it all together in one kind of structure. And I'd maybe leave the other question about...
I'll take one stab at it, and then the student financial aid expert can pick up the pieces. But, you know, shared responsibility has in it the mechanism to solve this problem that you're talking about. I mean, if you specify that here is the tuition that goes into a calculation of cost of attendance for the purposes of shared responsibility, there is a mechanism that would say, and if an institution wants to raise its tuition above that, that that institution becomes responsible for meeting the increased state aid, state student financial aid, that would be required by that tuition increase. That makes this whole thing self-regulating. It doesn't mean that you have to intervene at every institution at every point. And my sense is, and I haven't read the law completely, or the proposed legislation, but SB 9 pretty well has in it those features, I think. But I think you really want to move toward a situation in which you establish a benchmark and then allow institutions, if their price points will allow it, given who they serve, and etc., if they can raise their tuition above that, let them do it, except that they have to take responsibility themselves for meeting the unmet need of the students that are occasioned by that increase in tuition.
And it will play out very, very different for different institutions.
If you were to have a coordinated commission, one of their responsibilities would be to bring to you a budget, a state budget, that blended essentially the concepts of appropriations, tuition policy, and financial aid policy, so that when you thought about one of those, you'd be thinking about all three of those, because they all affect both access and quality. And what you need is the capacity to think about those things together and to see that there is a cohesive plan and moving toward that. I think I would agree with Dennis. I think your shared responsibility concept is a very good framework for having that discussion. It doesn't mean, though, frankly, if you look around, there's great avarice for not having tuition policy within the legislature. Higher education really would love that. But if you look at the states that don't have that, you still have that. You have an appropriations pool that's fairly substantial, and that in as you set your policies, you are also affecting tuition policy, whether you have it directly or not. I think there's strong, good reasons to give, if you're going to give the power of management to the boards, to give them greater responsibility for tuition setting. But they'd be damn fools to think that they really had control of that if they were moving that direction. I will mention one thing on the the concept of P20 boards. We actually have proof of concept for that in four or five states, or I should say proof of that it doesn't work. There are four states that have basically operated that way for a long period of time, and one that recently moved toward that, and none of them have essentially worked. And I think those states are, I mean, in our region, Idaho has a state board of education that has responsibility over post-secondary education. Around the country, for all practical purposes, that's Pennsylvania's system. It's to the extent that Michigan has anything, it's Michigan's, New York's, and now Florida. And Florida's the most recent example, and it simply hasn't worked. They've had to try to find workarounds, and I think there are two reasons. One is that the cultures of post-secondary and elementary secondary are so different that it's very hard to have those discussions together. There's a reason why you have a subcommittee on higher education separate from elementary and secondary, and it was because you needed that discussion. It was a different discussion. So that's one reason. And the other is that those little kids are so much more not cute. They're so much more perceived to be so much more important. Every community has a grade school, a middle school, and a high school or more. And they have a local control, a local board. And they're going to be extremely important for your state public policy. And the feds are very active in that. And it just demands so much attention that it tends to leave higher education out of that. So if you really want to leave higher education alone, a P20 council is an excellent way to go.
Hey. Gentlemen, we thank you again for your expertise, your guidance, and helping the task force basically, through you, cherry pick the best practices in this country that encompasses these three bills before. So look forward to working on you through this phase of the process, working with you through this phase of the process. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us
back.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up the Chancellor of Higher Education, George Bernsteiner. Chair Kelly.
Thank you, Chair Haas, Co-Chair Jembro, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, George Pernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and I'm joined today by Paul Kelly, who is the president of the Oregon State Board of Higher Education. I first want to thank all of you for being here today and having this hearing. I think it's very important. It really is the next step in the efforts that the Higher Education Work Group conducted in the interim, and I wanted to thank Senator Haas, Representative Reed, who co-chaired the group, and Senator Morse, Representative Dembro, Representative Springer, who were on that group, and Director Richardson, from whom you heard earlier, all of you helped create the bill that's before you, and I appreciate all the effort that went into that. I appreciate, too, the work of the consultants from NCHEMS and WICHE. You just heard from them, and I know that their guidance was important to you, but it was also important to us to understand the framework, both of the bill and of how Oregon fits within the rest of the country. We are at a time, as you know, where in the university system, and I believe in the community colleges as well, but at least in the university system, we have record student enrollment. We also are awarding, we awarded last year and will again this year, a record number of degrees. We have record levels of student success on almost any measure you can imagine. And it wasn't always thus. 40-40-20 demands that we continue that momentum. If not, we will not have the kind of competitive workforce, competitive economy, and successful adult population in Oregon that will mean that the state and its citizens will be successful in this 21st century. You saw the slides that Dennis and David and Ames put up earlier about the education level in Oregon in comparison to that in other countries and in other states. It is essential that we have a higher level of education, and Senate Bill 253 lays out one roadmap, if you will, to get us there. But how do we do that at a time when we're facing major budget reductions? Governor Kitzhaber this morning laid out the budget from for the 2011-13 biennium, which for the universities and the community colleges both showed significant reductions from current appropriation levels. And yet we are now at all-time high enrollment levels. How do we square those two competing dimensions and still maintain the momentum we have created? I want to turn us back for a moment to the 1990s, because the chart that Dennis showed you on education level is a direct result of the policy choices that we all made as a state in the 1990s when we were faced with other budget reductions. In the universities, we reduced enrollment and eliminated programs. And if you track back the 25 to 34-year-olds on his chart, which were the lowest educated adults on that chart, they are all the people who should have been in college in the 1990s. That's who we didn't serve. We can see directly what happens when we don't serve Oregonians. When we don't educate Oregonians, we wind up with a less educated adult population than in other states, than in other countries, or than in other generations. And so really the question before us is, how do we sustain the very positive momentum we now have, a momentum which has carried us to the level of enrollment we will need if we are to meet 40-40-20, at least the first 40. How do we do that even in a time of budget reductions? And that's really the question that we posed to our State Board of Higher Education more than a year ago, and that really led to the discussion that we want to have today. I think Board President Kelly will be able to talk about that.
Thanks, George. Chair Hass, Co-Chairs Dembrough and Johnson, and members of the committee, to reintroduce myself briefly, Paul Kelly. I do have the honor, and that's what I consider it to be, to serve currently as the president of the State Board of Higher Education. The only thing I'd add by myself is I reside in Portland, fortunately in Representative Dembrough's district. I'd like to tell you just in a few minutes some background on how the board got to the adoption of the proposal
for the governance change and restructuring, moving from a state agency to the more agile, autonomous public university system that we have proposed, which is now incorporated in Senate Bill 242. As the Chancellor said, we began this process a bit over a year ago in earnest. Actually, you could probably go back a couple of more years to a more superficial look at some governance questions. But after our retreat in December of 2009, we got into this in earnest. The process involved board members, university presidents, faculty members, students, and a variety of other administrators within the system. The proposal was adopted unanimously by the board in July of 2010, so just this past year. And as you know, or at least some of you know, all seven presidents of our universities signed a letter to the work group on higher ed, fully endorsing the board's proposal. When we began this process, we were mindful of some principles that I think are important to summarize. They included following the board's the goals adopted several years previously, which are to increase the education level of Oregon's adults, to provide high-quality education in that process, to provide research for innovation and a successful state of Oregon, and to contribute to the civic and economic success of communities throughout the state. We are also mindful of the fact that the public purpose of our seven universities and the system is paramount in importance in the process. We focused on student success in whatever we were going to propose as a focal point, and we focused on how to provide affordable access to all Oregonians, and we focused on outcomes and performances that were key to Oregon's and the system's future. The proposal, in a nutshell, as you know, is essentially to transform what has been since 1929 a state agency to a public university system with greater flexibility and autonomy. And to change the focus, if you will, and the mindset of what we're doing from a regulatory mindset, which it has been, I think, historically as a state agency, to a more entrepreneurial mindset that we think will be better for the future of the state. And lastly, I'd like to personally, and on behalf of the other 11 members of the Board of Higher Ed, thank the higher ed work group, and to thank both Senate and House leadership for creating that work group. We very much appreciated the hard work and good thought that the work group put into this, and we frankly applaud the results, which now are in front of you as Senate Bill 242. Thank you.
As you look at the bills before you, you have three of them. Senate Bill 253, I mentioned earlier, which establishes the 40-40-20 goals in statute. That's related really to a view of what it will take to create a successful Oregon adult population for the 21st century. You heard Dennis talk about the components of that and how our focus may be a bit more ambitious than that of other states, but it is not unusual. And it gives us, if you will, a goal that we can strive to achieve. The second bill before you, which is Senate Bill 254, deals with dual credit. And really what we have found, as I've noted to committees before, is that those students who come to us having earned a substantial number of either advanced placement, international baccalaureate, or dual credit coursework in high school actually will complete their college educations they're more likely to complete and more likely to complete in 4 years than just about any other group of students. So there is evidence to suggest that facilitating the ability of high school students to succeed in those kinds of courses will, in fact, improve our ability as a state to help reach the 40-40-20 goals and perhaps all three elements of those 40-40-20 goals. The third proposal
before you is Senate Bill 242. Senate Bill 242 embodies the board's proposal that Paul just talked about, and it also embodies the coordinating commission that the consultants spoke about earlier. That coordinating commission focuses on all of post-secondary education in order to facilitate the 40 and the 40. We know that true facilitation of the 40-40-20 goal, though, involves all of education in Oregon, as Representative Dembro suggested earlier on. Focusing on the outcomes of all of Oregon education, pre-K, K-12, and post-secondary, would be needed in order to ensure the success of Oregon and Oregonians, and in fact the achievement of the 40-40-20 goals. The board's proposal that Paul alluded to has some salient features that I want to spend just a couple minutes on now. The first is that it would use the tuition paid by students to educate students without the universities having to seek special legislative approval. Many of you know that we have gone numerous times to the Assembly and the Emergency Board to receive special approval to spend the money students have already paid us in order to educate them. And sometimes we get that, and sometimes it's deferred. The difficulty for planning, which that gives, the difficulty for hiring of faculty, the difficulty for advising of students due to the uncertainty is not insignificant, and therefore is something that would be changed and, if you will, cured by the bill before you. The second is it would protect the fund balances of the universities for use by the universities. The third is that interest earnings on tuition monies would be spent by the universities. And the Board Governance Committee 2 weeks ago said not only would it be spent by the universities, it would be spent by the universities for need-based grant aid. So, and essentially, it would be used for financial aid for students at the universities. We would establish, for the first time, a tuition-setting process that formally and explicitly involves students. Right now, under statute and for many years, the State Board of Higher Education has set tuition. It has done so through whatever processes it finds fit in any given year, and with whatever guidance the governor and the legislature might choose to give it. But it has never had a formal process involving students on the campuses to advise on what the level of tuition might be. This proposal would change that and explicitly involve students in that process. It would also allow the universities to save money on things like risk management, where we would be able to procure insurance for the universities at what we believe will be lesser cost than we're able to do today. That's because we would be able to pool it with other universities with their risk profiles and be able then to have opportunity for savings that we do not currently enjoy. We would focus, as Paul indicated, on a performance compact instead of on compliance with what could be a couple of thousand line items right now in the budget buildup. The first three areas of that performance compact deal with enrollment, with degrees, and degrees in shortage areas. In other words, they deal with student success, but in every area of the state, for every socio-demographic group within the state, and for every income level within the state. Those are important distinctions that the board will focus on. Just as one of the consultants told you, it doesn't do much good to reach 40-40-20 if you leave whole areas of the population out of that success. So part of the focus and part of the compact deals not just with the total numbers, but also with the numbers and the proportions of various populations throughout the state, rural areas, low-income students, and so forth. Affordability for Oregon students is another important dimension of the performance compact. And the board has wrestled with what does that mean? How would we define it? How would we ensure it? How would we make certain that the universities provided the level of financial aid necessary for Oregon students to be able to attend and succeed
in achieving their degrees. And that's part of, then, this discussion that we will have, part of the compact that the universities would have with the state. A focus on economic vitality through the research enterprise of the universities. As you know, right now, today, we receive as much money each year from the federal government to conduct research as we do from the state to educate students. And by next year, that's likely to be more money from the federal government for research than from the state for educating students. But how do we make sure that the research, which our faculty are very, very good at doing, redounds to the benefit also of Oregon and Oregonians? And that's part of the focus area, then, that would be part of this discussion. Cost effectiveness, mentioned also by the consultants, very important to our board to make sure that the programs that we offer, the outcomes that we achieve, are done in the least cost manner possible, consistent with the quality that is necessary for what we need in our adult population, which gets to the last point, which is employer satisfaction with the performance of graduates. We are trying to figure out what is an appropriate quality measure for our graduates, and we will probably improve on this one over time. But for right now, what we intend to do is to survey Oregon employers about how effective are our graduates at doing the work that's essential for Oregon to move forward and for their businesses to be successful. It's a way of tying back both the relevance and the quality of our degrees to the number, because we know we're supposed to raise the number, but it doesn't do much good to raise the number unless you also ensure an adequate level of quality. And so if you look at the seven areas that the board is focused on with regard to a performance compact, they are enrollment, degrees, degrees in shortage areas, affordability for Oregon students, research for economic vitality, cost effectiveness, and employer satisfaction. Changing the way in which we relate to state government, focusing on the outcomes we are seeking, focusing on the achievement of quality education within the context of the state's goals for an educated citizenry, that's really what this change is about. That's really what going from being a state agency to being a public university system is about. It is about sustaining the momentum we have gained in the last few years that has led to record enrollment and record degrees. Does that mean that we will never need state money? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But what it means is that for whatever level of state investment is made, in whatever biennium is there, we can operate more effectively by being a public university system than we can be as a state agency. And we will tie that to the performance compact with the state. Maintaining momentum that focuses on student success is what this proposal is about. The Oregon University System will remain a public entity. It will remain a public entity that now is focused on accountability for results, but is still subject to all of the other kinds of things one thinks about with regard to ethics, audits, public meetings, and other public requirements that you normally consider with regard to a public entity. Those things are not going to change. What is changing is a focus on accountability. What is changing is agency status. Any questions at this point?
Questions? Committee?
Very good.
Thank you, Chairs. I'm listening to the whole thing, and I'm new to the committee, so bear with me a little bit. One of the things, obviously, I get a little nervous about is that, as an employer, I get people who have certificates from private institutions that are very, very capable. Meaning these are for-profit or non-profit, but they're private institutions where they get additional training or they get additional certificates and all these things. And one of the things I think that kind of makes me just a little bit nervous about this is, as you sweep everything into an autonomous organization, you could have a bias against innovative new players in the front of higher education. Meaning you could have a business that comes forward and says, we really want to train people in solar or geothermal or something and compete directly with OIT or something like that. And it seems like to me that we need to make sure we're encouraging as much activity in this area of higher ed and continuing education as we possibly can. So we kick this off to this non-state agency. How do we make sure that that non-state agency doesn't become a predatory institution that, in essence, goes after or tries to suppress competition from folks that may want to do it outside that arena? It seems like to me we want to broaden education as much as possible, and everybody that wants to participate should be allowed to participate in doing that. How do we make sure that that's protected?
Chair Haas, Senator George, thanks for the question. We need every capable provider of education in this state we can find to meet the kind of goals we're talking about. So I don't see anything in either this bill or in the board's governance proposal that in any way is anti-competitive, if you will. The focus here is all about raising education levels. The board's governance proposal deals only with the university system and does not deal with what others may choose to do. If you go into Senate Bill 242 and the Coordinating Commission, if you look there, and you know, I think the consultants have also talked about it, you want to take advantage also of the abilities of your independent sector in looking at how you will achieve the state's goals. And that's one of the reasons that the Opportunity Grant, for example, is offered to students at those independent colleges and universities. It was viewed at the time that was created and when its predecessor grant program was created as being part of it was in the state's interest to offer that kind of financial aid. You now have within the Office of Degree Authorization, which is in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission right now, the organization that takes a look at all of the institutions in the state who want to offer post-secondary credentialing. And they are basically the ones who are currently charged, and as I understand it under Senate Bill 242, that coordinating commission similarly would be charged with taking a look at the quality of those entities. That's not something the Oregon University system does now. It's not something the Oregon University system would do under Senate Bill 242 or under any of the other proposals that might be advanced. That sort of thing is really done by another entity, but I think the only way that we as a state meet our overall goals is to welcome as many qualified providers as possible to do as much as they possibly can. And that, you know, because we are well behind where we need to be.
Sure. I'd be more comfortable if we had a statement somewhere in the bill that actually said it, that that's part of our goal and objective to this. And I didn't see it in the bill anywhere. We want to make sure that we're encouraging these types of sort of non-traditional methods of education. So just kind of my insight in listening. So thanks.
Other comments or questions?
I do. Yes. Okay. Mr. Chancellor, so I wonder if you could help. I have a couple of questions. The first one is, I think it would help us if you could share with us some of the really concrete challenges that you face as a state agency. And one of those that really drove home to me the rationale for making this change was the recent experience that OUS had before the interim Ways and Means group back in December, where you found yourselves faced with growing enrollment, a need to increase courses in order to meet that enrollment, tuition dollars that were available because of that growing enrollment, and yet an inability to issue contracts or schedule classes or whatever to meet that enrollment, even though you had the responsibility because you needed e-board authority. And I wonder if you could explain that a little.
Senator Haas, Representative Dembro, I'd be pleased to do that. That's really what the term of art is called, other funds expenditure limitation. The legislature, each biennium,
appropriates an amount of state funding for the universities and then sets a limit on how much other funds the universities are allowed to spend. So that isn't state money, it's other money. And in this case, in our case, that's usually tuition dollars. What has happened in this current biennium is we've had a very rapid increase in enrollment, and therefore we have enrolled many, many students. Well, the first year of the biennium, you're operating under the two-year limitation, and so you know you have enough in the first year to get through without exceeding the limit the legislature has set. When you come into the second year and you experience that rapid growth again, we had to go back to the legislature and say, we have thousands more students who have already paid us millions more dollars. We would like to be able to spend those dollars to educate the students. We hired the faculty and the advisors, and we, because the students were there, and we sought then approval from the legislature to spend the money the students had already paid. That approval was deferred. It was deferred in August before the start of the school year, which is when we first asked, and it was deferred again in December until after this next revenue forecast. And I can understand that the caution of the Emergency Board and the Ways and Means Committee about the overall fiscal situation of the state of Oregon. But the situation in which that puts us, frankly, is that we will then be into February or thereabouts, March perhaps, and hopefully we will receive approval. If we do not, in order to avoid overspending, not state money, not appropriation, but tuition money, overspending the tuition limit, we'll have to start closing down enrollment in the spring term, which again, interrupts the momentum we have started and essentially is, in many ways, makes it difficult for us to continue the students on the way to their degrees if they can't get the classes, because that's essentially what that will mean. We'll just close off sections. We don't want to do that, and I don't think anybody really wants us to do that. And I have fully expect and hope that the legislature will approve the request. But the fact that we have to continue to ask and worry about whether or not it will happen does make a difference on how the presidents and the provosts and the institutions plan for and schedule the classes for students. And I think that's the biggest difficulty that we face in that regard.
Chancellor, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Kelly, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. I do want to keep an eye on the clock here. We're going to get kicked out of this room shortly, so what I would like to do now is temporarily close this public hearing, go into a work session on 242 to adopt the OHSU amendment. The legal counsel is still here if we have any questions. It essentially defangs OHSU from 242. And then briefly return to a public hearing. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bills 242, 253, and 254 and go into a work session on Senate Bill 242.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments dated January 27, 2011.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 242 dated January 27, 2011. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion to adopt the amendment is adopted. And now I want to reopen public hearing on Senate Bills 242, 253, and 254. We do have some people who did travel a ways to get here, and I would like to have them come up here now. Madeline Goodwin, Lauren Goodwin. Margaret DeLacy, I don't know if this is you want to come up too. Okay.
It looks like they expanded options.
Welcome to the Oregon Capitol. You're here speaking on Senate Bill 254.
Sorry, what?
You were speaking on 254.
We both have really lousy hearing, so.
What? Identify yourselves for the record, and welcome to the Capitol.
Thank you. So we're speaking on?
We're speaking about Senate Bill 254. I'm Madeline Goodwin. This is my mom, Corn.
You can just read from what you got there, kiddo.
Okay.
And she's never done this before, so.
I'm from Grants Pass. I am a 14-year-old early entry student at Southern Oregon University. So, I'm just going to read from what I got. I support this bill because I know there are other kids like me who learn at an accelerated pace and need the intellectual stimulation college-level material provides. I'm sure there are concerns about having younger students on campus. Any kids who can't behave themselves appropriately, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to take online courses. Allowing kids to learn at their own pace encourages them to learn because they don't have to sit there and learn the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. The workforce of the 21st century will require lifelong learning. Encouraging people to learn will help ensure a successful workforce.
Just tell them how much you love being able to take your classes. This is her second year as a part-time student at the university. She's doing fabulously, and she was just asked to assist one of her professors with research. I think that there's really no question that she's capable of handling the work or behaving appropriately.
And so if I can, then why shouldn't other people my age, or even younger, if they're ready?
So she's here to show you that this is a real face and a real person, and that there are actually students like this who want to learn and move ahead, and it would be great if they were able to do that. So she's an early entry program at this time.
Yeah.
We appreciate that. You coming forward and admire your success at such a young age, and the fact that you were able to earn some college credits, put them in the bank. Mom helps with the college bills down the road. Yes? I think that's one of the driving forces behind that dual credits bill. So thank you for coming up.
Any questions, committees? Okay, I had my own presentation. So
if you want to highlight it, we have it up here.
It's pretty brief here. In addition to being mom, my name is Corinne Goodwin, and I'm also the executive director of a nonprofit called Gifted Homeschoolers Forum. We started actually in the Bay Area and about six years ago, and grew because you had gifted organizations that were focusing on schools, but you had a lot of, especially with standards-based curriculum, the schools weren't able to meet the needs of a lot of students, and so the families were just pouring out, not knowing what to do. And so we've grown. We've got a huge number of members, including quite a few in Oregon. We also live in Oregon, in Grants Pass. We support 254 in general because Oregon students need access to advanced classes. We hear so many times, oh, you're just pushing your kid. They can just do what everyone else is doing, but they can just do more. That's not encouraging the enthusiasm of lifelong learning that Madeline was referring to. I'm not pushing her. It's more a question of chasing to keep up. Believe me.
If anything, she's trying to keep me from pushing myself too
hard. Yes.
Yeah.
If students are ready to move ahead and you've got these goals of 40 and 40, you know, forget the 20 for a minute. If you've got students who want to learn and want to move ahead, what's the point of holding them back and saying, no, no, you've got to continue doing the same old work again until you're 18? She's here, she's 14, and she's not alone. She's not the only one. Research shows that a disproportionate number of students identified whether they're identified or not as gifted, tend to fall into the dropout and disaffected groups. That's not where we need our brain power for the 21st century workforce. We don't want those people to be, you know, on the streets or doing drugs or taking a job flipping burgers. We want to encourage them to move ahead. We'd also like the committee to understand that even though the bill specifically says 9th through 12th grade should have access to advanced curriculum or dual credits, in some cases, some of the students who are younger, Madeline started at SOU the day after her 13th birthday. She would have been in 8th grade if she was in public school. And she's done very well ever since. So sometimes you have younger students and they're ready. We're not saying that you want to have a bunch of 7-year-olds running around community college, okay? We're saying that there are some students, and even though you have, you know, your average general students, you have children who are far enough out there that you have to be aware that they exist and that these outliers need to be addressed a little bit differently. So many students are homeschooling because they ran out of options at their local schools. That probably makes up the majority of our nonprofit's membership, families who would love to have their kids in school, but what are they going to do there? I mean, if I put her in school right now, what would she do? I mean, she's getting A's and B's in college. So I think that kind of wraps it up. Do you have any questions?
Questions?
I have a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you can hear me. Madeline or Madeline's mom, was it difficult for you to get into college? Did you have to pull a lot of strings and
better let me
take a lot of work to take that step?
So we already were homeschooling, and I didn't actually know what the process was since we didn't want her to be a full-time student. For the first quarter, we had no advance notice. I said to her, "You know, you're really bored. We should consider college one of these days." And she said, "How about now?" So I went to the website and I filled out, you know, because it says any student can do this. And I think they've changed it now, where if your age is under a certain level, you're automatically forwarded to the early entry program. But at the time, that was not the case. So we filled out her information, included her accurate birth date, and she was a non-admitted student. She started taking classes, and the early entry program people found out that she was there, and they approached us, and they met with Madeline and me, but mostly Madeline. They saw her grades. She had to prove herself. Then over a period of, well, the first quarter, she was more or less on probation with their program, and by the second quarter, her grades were such that they just accepted her into the program. Now, I understand that that's changing, that they are setting up a certain amount of criteria, so I can't speak to that. I can't tell you what it would look like for someone else right now. But for us, we have had a lot of hoops to jump through because there is no real program and there's no criteria. So that would be a really useful thing to have, because as it is, we go from here to there to here to there, and we never know from quarter to quarter what's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Margaret DeLacy, did you want to? I know you had a quick point.
Somebody's laptop here. Is this the legislature's laptop?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Margaret DeLacy, and I am here representing the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted. OTAG is a statewide nonprofit. We represent, provide information and support to families and gifted students throughout the state. I would like to speak in favor of Senate Bill 254. OTAG, the first time I ever came to legislature, it was to support a similar bill. I think that was about 15 years ago, so I'm very pleased that the committee has written this and brought it forward. I would like to recommend some tweaks to the bill, kind of suggest some friendly amendments, and if you don't mind, I'm not going to read them, but I would like to discuss them. The first is that on page 1, Section 1, It requires that districts basically provide a two-thirds match for any grant money. The state will provide a one-third match. My advice would be to not to have that written into the statute. It's possible that down the road, for example, you might get a federal grant that would specify a different match, and then it would have to go all the way back through committee hearings, chamber hearings, go all the way through the process. It's a very cumbersome process, as I know only too well, and I would suggest that you direct the State Board of Education to write appropriate administrative rules that could be changed if need be, rather than have that spelled out in black and white here. Section 4 on page 2, you just heard from Madeline. We do speak on an occasional basis. We don't have a huge number of students, but we do have students who are younger than ninth grade who really do need access to college programs. The youngest students I've encountered one from another state who's attending community college as a young elementary student. There aren't a lot of students in this category, but we don't understand why the access to instruction should be limited to students in grades 9 through 12. I would suggest it just say provide students with access instead of just students in grades 9 through 12. And on page 3, section 7, the waiver process allows the State Department of Education to offer waivers to school districts that provide these programs. And I would just like to explain to the committee that that doesn't necessarily mean that those programs will be made available to every student. In a large district, you could get a waiver if you had any advanced placement classes in any of your high schools, presumably. That would meet the waiver requirement, and you could continue the waiver as long as you had that program. That doesn't necessarily mean that students on other campuses, for example, would be able to take those advanced placement classes. So I would suggest taking another look at that language as well. And now if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Appreciate your suggestions. I do. Committee, questions? Appreciate your endorsement of this concept, and we will look at these possible amendments.
I included in my written testimony links to several large studies that have been done on dual credit programs. I'm sure the committee is already aware that the research is very strongly in favor of providing these programs. They save money. They have very high satisfaction rates. They produce good outcomes for everybody. I have not been able to find any information about a negative outcome from such a program. So I would really encourage you to move forward with this.
Thank you. Margaret, I do have a question. Do you have available example? Not, you don't need to give it to us now, but I would appreciate getting some examples of districts which are, you know, as it were, getting around the waiver expectation currently. Or, you know, where you would expect there to be problems that change in this language would fix. Are there, you know, in your estimation, are there many districts out there that are not extending accelerated learning opportunities because they're just targeting to a small group?
Senator Haas, Representative Dembro, and Representative Johnson. What I would say to that, I'd be happy to go into specifics with you later, is that what we're finding is not that districts don't do it at all, but that it isn't consistently available. So a school or guidance counselor may have one really great program somewhere, but that doesn't mean that every student has access to it. Even students who might be able to take advantage of it, they may not know it. We've been looking at school websites, for example, to see if that information is made public on their website, and often it isn't there. So I'd be happy to kind of go into a little bit more detail later, but we have had that experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committees, we have two witnesses left, and we're going to get kicked out of here soon. I want Emma Calloway of the Oregon Student Association,
and Josette Green from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Do you want to come? Okay. Way of introduction, Josette is new to Oregon from Florida, executive director of the Student Assistance Commission, only to come here and find out the commission is going to be abolished.
Right, that was quite an awakening, yes.
Appreciate your patience and your help with this, in this process.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the Senate Education and Workforce Committee, and co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, and members of the House Higher Education Subcommittee. I'm Josette Green, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 242. And with me, I have one of our seven commissioners, Commissioner Mike Holland, who is here to support the testimony as well as answer any questions. I want to commend Senator Haas and Representative Reed and the work group for the fine work they've done on creating Senate Bill 242 and the ability for higher education to come together with one strategic policy and objective and move forward in creating that. I'd like to share with you ways that OSAC can be a partner in this going forward. But there are some tweaks, fixes, and observations that I'd like to share with you. OSAC wants to be a partner in the progression of Senate Bill 242 so that the programs maintain integrity and oversight for our citizens, stakeholders, and our students are well served in this nation, in this state. Indeed, we want to see the progress towards a 40-40-20 plan, and access to higher education and completion of higher education is the way to do that. The mission of OSAC, and we are the only agency in the state that provides this mission, and that is to access higher education. We have a very active working agency with constant need for policy development and program oversight. So I'd like to discuss with you eight different items, how we can strengthen this bill in relation to OSAC, and OSAC continue to serve our students. First of all is neutrality. OSAC advocates for all students across Oregon, whether for-profit, non-profit, two-year, four-year, public, private. And it's important that OSAC maintain that neutrality in the face of a coordinating commission that's dedicated to the public sector. We have a concern that perhaps there might be some push or bias towards the public sector, and it's important that we maintain the neutrality to serve all of our students. Replacing OSAC's existing commissioners with the coordinating commission will leave OSAC without a governing body. Our commissioners play a vital role. They play a number of different roles. They are our audit committee. They are a hearing approving body for administrative rules. They are the adverse impact committee. They're a policy board. They're a liaison to various agency program areas. They're a listening ear for the various sectors, for students and organizations. They play a vital role in going forward, and governance is essential. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission is dedicated to policy and strategic development. Governance needs to continue for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We do have that very active working commission with programs to administer, rules to write, processes to develop, technical decisions to make. If we're folded into a higher-level policy board, OSAC is without the nimbleness to be able to address the policies and policy decisions and program administration that we need. Within OSAC currently is housed the Office of Degree Authorization, ODA. Senate Bill 242 eliminates ODA as a named entity, but retains a regulatory staff and functions. As part of the coordinating commission, ODA floats free and is without line reporting responsibility and program management. OSAC operates on fees in regard to its scholarship programs and in ODA, and we want to ensure that those fees stay within those program areas, are not used elsewhere, so that those programs can continue and support our students and programs across the state. One of the roles that our commissioners plays is in regard to relationships with a number of our scholarship donors. Within our organization, 28% of our funds to students come from scholarships, and they're administered through OSAC. We maintain relationships with the Oregon Community Foundation, with the Ford Family Foundation, and others, donors, and those relationships are very important. And our commissioners play a large role in maintaining and continuing those solid relationships. If within a coordinating commission, OSAC is a smaller player, and we want to ensure that funding remains and is not diverted to what is considered other higher priorities within higher education. Our governor today announced that additional $20 million is going to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and we want to continue that level of funding and support and growth for our students and to get them educated so we achieve the 40-40-20. Our commission meetings are a vital, fertile ground for voices. We hear the voices of students. We hear the voices of organizations, such as the Oregon Student Association, and we continue to do that. And so the commission offers that opportunity for these voices to be heard. If there are no commission meetings, then there is no voice.
Ms. Green, I'm going to stop you right there in the interest of time. And if it's okay with you, let's keep this conversation going. I want to push back on a few of those things, mainly that last point that there's no voice of students, when in fact the legislation calls for not one but two students, higher ed, university student, and community college student, to be appointed to the commission. You mentioned OSAC is nimble, and this was before you got here, but there were some... there were some problems in the last year with this agency, and you can describe it any way you want, but you wouldn't use the word nimble in describing some of the issues that OSAC, this agency, had before. So I do appreciate your pointing out the Office of Degree Authorization note. I think that probably should be spelled out. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. So I look forward to working with you on this and some amendments, and you have one of your commissioners here.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Haas, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Mike Holland. I am a new member of the commission. I might add, Senator Haas, Chair Haas, that it's not at all coincidental that we have a new executive director of the commission and several new commissioners because of some of the problems that you allude to. I think it is important to represent accurately the Student Assistance Commission's view of the bill, and Josette has done a good job so far. But in regard to the commission itself and its abolition in the proposed text of Senate Bill 242, one of the things that we think may not have been fully considered is what impact the work that's necessary to move the business of the commission forward will have on what you are trying to set up as a policy, budgetary, in some ways a macro oversight board for higher education investment in the state of Oregon. If that commission that is set up in this bill really needs to treat and deal with the Student Assistance Commission work, I'm not sure you're going to have a lot of time for the policy discussion. So what I think will happen, and I would worry about this with the text of the bill, is that the work of the commission and the oversight of $97 million, maybe $120 million of state resources that's connected to 56,000 students, $36 million of private scholarship investment that's connected to 7,000 students, the management of relationships between all of the independent institutions, the university system, the 17 community colleges, all becomes the province of an administrator without any public body oversight, because I just don't think the coordinating commission is going to get to this stuff in this work. So we think the bill, we think where you're going, makes a lot of sense in many, many ways and on many, many levels. And we would like very much to work with the committee, representatives, chair, that the chairs may direct us to find a way to keep this commission intact but still be subject to the accountability, the oversight responsibilities that are set forth in the bill. I must say, if this committee disagrees with that view, proceeds down the path to eliminate the commission, there's not a single commissioner that's going to fall on a sword about this. I mean, I don't get paid. This is not a job that I have to worry about. And I think the staff will be taken care of. There's enough work for the staff to do, even under a new organizational structure.
Well, thank you.
But I would worry.
I do thank you for those comments, and I look forward to working with Ms. Green as we work through this bill. Eric, could I convince you to come back Thursday and submit your testimony, your written testimony now?
Yeah, I will submit my written testimony. When you read over it, if you could just look particularly at a couple points. One, our comments on local boards. Second, our comments on potential tuition review committees on each campus and how students can be involved in that process. And then maintaining democratic checks and balances and accountability, and we'll continue to ask questions, but we're excited about collaborative work ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Committees, representatives, thank you for a very full day. To the senators, we will try to move one of these bills on Thursday. Do your homework. We'll be talking. Thank you. We are adjourned.
And so are we.